Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. This season, and especially the year 1994, has been a lot about bringing back old IP and nostalgia. We've mostly found that these movies are made with love by people who had loved the original source material and have wanted to update it to not only connect with modern audiences, but also pay homage to the things that they really cared about, highlighting it in a way that they think works best. It could be argued that one of the greatest film homage artists of all time is George Lucas, who, of course, created films which would then inspire filmmakers to make their own love letters. If you look at George Lucas's career, there's a huge gap where he goes away from hands-on directorial filmmaker from Star Wars in 1977 to, well, The Phantom Menace in 1999. But his influence as an executive producer and story creator is all over the 80s and 90s, even in places you wouldn't expect it. And today we're going to look at two of those movies, Radioland Murders and The Shadow. But before we do that, Cam, Alicia, let's have a look at Lucas as executive producer and the quite fascinating reason why he wasn't directing the films he was helping to create. Who wants to start on this one?
Cam, I feel like you've always had a nice defense of Lucas at this point, which I agree with.
You love Howard the Duck, Alicia. Do not stop.
Oh, Howard's coming up, Becky. Yeah, I've got a whole paragraph written on Howard.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the interesting thing, the thing that I always point to that I don't know if we've talked about it on the podcast or just on the series, is that he was always considered of the, like, movie brats, the experimental weirdo interesting one. Like, if you talk to especially Francis Ford Coppola,
yeah,
he says that he thought that that was going to be the guy who changed film. And of course, the monkey's paw irony is he absolutely did change film, but not in the way Francis Ford Coppola
and keeping in mind Coppola produced the feature version of his student film THX 1138. Some people say 1138, I'm unclear which one it is, but which is 1971.
It's an interesting thing, and I think you see a lot of that in his early executive producing. A bunch of those guys, of course, came together for Kagamusha, the Kurosawa film, to help fund that. They came together for Mishima, the Paul Schrader film.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's obsessed with Japanese film. See Star Wars, the Japanese movie adaptation that's not a Japanese movie adaptation. But he also has stuff like Body Heat, you know, Labyrinth that we talked about. He produces for Coppola Captain EO, which is a whole other weird situation. But yeah, he's a guy. He produces one of the sequels to Koyaanisqatsi. So he has this interest in, I think, funding unique film that wouldn't get funded. Like, that's kind of weird when you're like Kurosawa. But if you think of Martin Scorsese, I think he has a lot of the same eventual Martin Scorsese's producing all these foreign films
for
foreign filmmakers who he really respects. And I think Lucas weirdly comes from the same place. He kind of loses touch with that. But the other thing that I would point to, I guess, before I toss over to Alicia and what she thinks, is that you always have to also consider the fact that George Lucas, on top of funding all these film projects, is deeply invested in film technology, and both through Industrial Light and Magic, the special effects house, which we'll get into, which is heavily involved in Radioland Murders, weirdly. He's pushing forward, and by 1994, they're the absolute, the pinnacle of special effects. And also, the fascinating thing is, special effects, makeup effects, really developed from the 70s through the 80s, and a lot of it is through George Lucas. People like Rick Baker came through Star Wars, and all these guys who started their own houses came through ILM and came through Star Wars.
As, like, apprentices, basically. Like, young, in their early 20s, cutting their teeth on Star Wars.
And I think getting a check big enough. We talked about Tak Fujimoto. Tak Fujimoto was doing B camera ships blowing up, and that gave him enough money money and enough clout to go do his own thing. And then the other weird one, which is not really movie related, also THX, the sound system. He develops a crazy cinema sound in theaters, which is something else entirely. But then the other one I always want to point to, which is completely kind of off out of nowhere, but he was also innovating video games with LucasArts. LucasArts was a very forward-thinking video game company that absolutely changed, especially the way game narratives were thought of, which is kind of a fascinating whole other branch. But he just cared about stuff like that. So yeah, he had his fingers in a lot of pies. We won't really get into it. He's also a fascinating guy who's, you know, very interested in charity work. He's very interested in representation on film. I think with Radioland Murders, you see a so-so kind of nod to black people and the significance they had in the industry. But for something later like Red Tails, he was very obsessed with making an all-black cast movie, and he knew that he had to fund it himself because Hollywood studios were just not interested in an all-black film in 2012 or something. So
they weren't in fashion, Sam. It wasn't in fashion.
No. Yeah, so his argument was it never has been, and they're stupid. And unfortunately, Red Tails didn't do much, and it took Black Panther later to really get that done. But he's an interesting guy with ideas like that.
Well, there's another reason why George Lucas moved away from hands-on filmmaking, and Alicia knows a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I mean, this is kind of a personal element of George Lucas's life, but it's also important to point out, like, part of the reason he takes a step back from directing is he's a very active family man, which if we know Hollywood history, most men do not take that path. And so he was very active in raising, I think, both his, I think he has some adopted children and biological children, but a pretty large family. And that was something that was important to him. And he certainly had the resources and the finances and the clout to do that and knew he could kind of come back. You know, what is the gap with him directing?
20 years, it's 99 or 77 to 99. Yeah.
So Phantom Menace, yeah,
and
that
we talked, we will talk about on the series that he decided that his skills were better as a producer, even for Star Wars. And that's why he brought on Irvin Kershner, because he's like, I can't direct as on the fly by the seat of my pants as this. And I know that Irvin Kershner can. And that's part of why Empire Strikes Back is his best movie, because he brought on his mentor, who is a great improvisational film director. And he just knew he didn't have those skills.
Who we talked about in the very first episode of this podcast in season one, Irvin Kershner directed Eyes of Laura Mars, which is what got Lucas to hire him for
Empire. Do you think one of the reasons that he likes working with Spielberg so much is, as we've discovered, Spielberg is that kind of like maniac off the cuff director. So like he can bring that influence into it. I mean, they both obviously, we're going to talk about in a minute how they love serials. They love all that kind of stuff, which is why you have Indiana Jones.
Yeah. And I think that they both just have that kind of loose 70s feel where they like improv and they like doing whatever. I think a few of the problems we'll talk about with the film today are that, where he's maybe a little too rigid and not really rolling with the punches anymore and too stuck in the past. And weirdly, not the past of radio, but the past of 1970 whatever when this script was written.
Yeah, and for Star Wars, it works because Star Wars, of course, is very Buck Rogers, very space serials of the 1930s, including radio and early kind of serialized short films that you would see in a theater in the 1940s. But Star Wars is just that much removed where it works, whereas the film we're about to talk about is probably too close to trying to be essentially a remake of its source material, which is, frankly, too old in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Going back to the 40s doesn't make sense at that
early
point.
In his career, like pre-Star Wars early, is when he wrote the story for the movie that paid homage to two genres that he loved, the screwball comedy and the whodunit. And if you have a listen to the first episode of the season about Peter Bogdanovich's At Long Last Love, you're going to know that in the 70s, it would have fit in to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now, the movie was shelved, and we'll get into why later, and it didn't reemerge until 1994, weirdly in part because of the advancements made in CGI. And I think this movie had a ton of potential. It still does. And I remember really loving it when it first came out as a kid, but I was a very high energy child, so I was probably able to keep up with it at that point. And at the time, it was critically panned and was a major, major box office flop.
I think it's still, like, statistically, or if you look at the data, one of the largest losses
Yeah.
And the biggest drop off from first week box office to second week box office in film history is probably in the top 10 in terms of mm-hmm. worst received, worst, which obviously we chose to talk about on this podcast. And we've found some redeemable qualities about this film. But it is really important to note that this was the bomb of 1994.
Which I think it does have a lot of redeeming elements. Like, I think there's an amazing supported cast, like amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think like Bobcat Goldthwait, Stephen Tobolowsky, Michael McKean and Christopher Lloyd, just to name a few, are like the mm-hmm. MVPs of this movie and what they're doing.
Candy Clark. I the whole film, I was like, Candy Clark's in this. Candy Clark from Man Who Fell to Earth. Didn't recognize her. She's throughout the film. Had to figure it out later, like, oh, she's the woman in the audience without any dialogue.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. It's frenzied. Frenzied is going to be the word I use for this.
Yeah. Kinetic, frenzied. Yeah. Yeah, that's
definitely
good.
There's.
Have we said that the film is Radioland? Yes. I don't think we've said the title.
It's written on the podcast where you press start. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I mean, this review from the LA Times is brutal. It says, it never lets up and never shuts up. It's wearying, kind of like staring at a gasping hamster on an exercise wheel for 2 hours, which I think is cruel. I do not think that is correct.
There are moments in the film where the hamster steps off and I genuinely laughed, and I genuinely saw kind of the tunnel vision that, you know, George Lucas and the director he chose for this film, Mel Stewart.
Mel Smith, I saw it. I was like, I will say.
Sorry, Mel Smith.
You know what?
Yes,
it's written somewhere as Mel Stewart, because I fell for the same trap.
Yeah, I wrote down Mel Stewart. That's weird. His previous work was The Tall Guy, which was an early Jeff Goldblum film.
A delightful film.
Yeah, I would love to see that. But I don't know. We should probably talk about
that. That's the plot right. Cam, lead us through the plot, please, just quickly.
Well, it's
quickly, faster.
No. It's a fairly classic sort of setup of a screwball comedy. There is a husband and wife on the verge of divorce, Roger and Penny, played by Mary Stuart Masterson, who people know, and Brian Benben, who people may not know because he has not been famous for a long time.
I thought it was a typo.
I will get into Brian Benben and why he was a big deal at the time. But yes, anyway, they're bickering. Penny is the producer of a radio show, and Roger is the head writer of this kind of full radio channel that has all the radio shows you would ever want. And it's the launch of a new radio station. It's the launch day with a live audience, and they're performing everything live in front of everybody. And during this performance, this inaugural day, there are a series of murders and a mysterious voice which breaks in and accuses people of things.
Which suspiciously sounds a lot like The Shadow.
Yes,
it's definitely that growl.
Hardly time to say a prayer before we move on to the
what? And fairly quickly, the police come, led by Michael Lerner, and they suspect Roger. So it's up to Roger, who is the Patsy Fall guy, to try to be one step ahead of the police and solve this murder before he's in trouble. And Penny always believes it's not him, so she's helping out too. It's rat-a-tat dialogue, and throughout it all we're seeing all these different radio shows, which none of which are really real, but most are spoofs of existing radio programs you'll recognize, fake versions of The Shadow.
Or you have George Burns actually coming out in his last on-screen role and doing a comedy bit that he would have performed on radio.
It's literally one from the radio.
Earlier.
They just did it.
Yeah.
And same, there's a, interestingly, Rosemary Clooney also appears in her final film performance singing. Billy Barty, in his final last great film performance, he does the exact thing he did with Spike Jones. He performs the same song the same way. I suggest looking up, you can look up Billy Barty and Spike Jones in the 50s performing the song, and it's kind of fascinating.
We have talked about Billy Barty so many times.
Billy Barty had quite a career.
It's kind of amazing.
This is Billy Barty actually, I'm sure he did it with Spike Jones in the radio days, but Billy Barty was doing this in the 1950s with Spike Jones on television. So, and it's also kind of fascinating because Billy Barty is doing impressions of singers, and like, good luck to you identifying all the different singers he's pretending to be. But it's fascinating because you're like, oh, Billy Barty was an impressionist? Like, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. He was a vaudeville fake baby. He was an impressionist. He was a silent film star.
Yeah. I mean, for people who don't remember who Billy, so they don't have to look it up on their phone. If you listen to our episode on Legend, he's a little person performer actor who was in so many things, like the He-Man movie and like
and
our
Day
childhood.
Of the Locust,
is basically
we talked
Billy
about Billy
Barty
as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I do want to point to the fact that like a lot of people watching this, as you mentioned, in the 90s would have no idea what these references are, especially for like the modern audiences to be going to see it. And one of the reviews I saw, they were like, why the hell are there dancers at a radio show? And I'm like, that's the joke.
Yeah, it's like an Astaire and Rogers sort of clone. Yeah. There's a lot of clones in this film where you have people who are meant to look like the Andrews sisters. You have someone who's, I think, supposed to be Cab Calloway, someone who's supposed to be Spike Jones. And then you have an Astaire and Rogers like dancing duo, which it's, you know, there's a large audience watching this radio production, but you're right, they missed the joke. Yeah. And I think the reason for that is there are too many jokes in this film. It is exhausting. The slapstick is beginning to end. There's a Roger Ebert review that I'm just going to read a few lines from, and I think he really wanted to love this film, and I do think he's someone who's actually quite closely related to George Lucas at this point in his life. But he wrote, "But the movie just doesn't work. It's all action and no character, all situation and no comedy. The slapstick starts so soon and lasts so long that we don't have an opportunity to meet or care about the characters in a way that would make their actions funny. It's all just movement." And it's true. This film, the slapstick does a discredit to it, because when you have a film, like, let's say you have one of the Abbott and Costellos that's similar to this, like a Whodunit, which I know was a huge inspiration for Radioland Murders. We know, or I mean, we're not us because we are the wrong age group, but the main demographic at the time for Abbott and Costello knew Abbott and Costello. They had seen 20, 30 films with Abbott. Like, you didn't have, you could put them in any situation because you knew the characters, and that's what made the slapstick work. Here, there was moments where I was like, wait, who got murdered? And it took like 30 minutes for me to realize Jeffrey Tambor's not on screen anymore, so it was probably him. Because I was like, I can't keep track of all of these like 90s sitcom actors that I barely recognize and can name, and I can't tell what is happening. And then the slapstick, it's like, intense, too intense.
And there's moments too where like there's screwball elements of the dialogue, like they make one of those now no jokes, which like it's Jeffrey Tambor, and I do not remember the other actor is, but he's very famous as well. And they're too, and they're doing this bit of dialogue. I'm gonna play the clip right now.
Oh, Mr. Katzenbach, Ruffles said he'd like to speak to you right away. Said you'd know what it was about.
Ruffles,
trumpet player.
Oh, please, that horn blowing.
Now you listen to me, Junior. Don't you think that I don't know what's going on? Because I do know, and now you know that I know.
Listen, I don't know what you know that I know, but I do know that you don't know what you think you know.
Oh, no!
No.
And the problem I have with it is that they're missing the timing. Like, and I don't know if it's a director thing or if it's the fact that, like, they just had to learn it so fast. And I can't help but think about Down with Love, which is a movie I need to revisit because I remember really liking it, but I do not remember if it holds up. Cam is shaking his head.
But I know it has its fans. It has its fans, so.
It does. But I know they do that bit, because the magazine is called No, and they're like, well, how are things now at No? Do you know how things are now at No? Like, they do the same bit, but I remember it being quicker and funnier because it just was clearer.
I think that bit's probably good. I think watching that. God, yeah, I loved that film when that came out.
And we're going to talk about how that is actually done better. There's a moment of it, too, that's done better by Tim Curry in The Shadow, which I'm very excited to point to. Remind me. I'm going to bring it up.
But there's a few things to talk about here because, yeah, I agree that the script doesn't work. The directing is a little weird. The casting is interesting but doesn't function. But I think the number one thing that really sinks this is what Alicia was talking about, which is the references. And what has happened is that the monoculture, kind of the popular culture, has moved past it. This was a thing meant to appeal to baby boomers in the 1970s, but if you think of the other films, even the Flintstones is referencing something that is 30 years after this.
Well, and they used the Flintstones to advertise this. This was Radioland Murders. The trailer was directly put onto the Flintstones, thinking that it would appeal to the same boomer generation as the Flintstones.
No, and Flintstones clearly appeals to not boomers because you could watch it on TV. Yeah. But also,
it appealed to us, and
if
we aren't
think
boomers.
About it, like, we were 10 also, years old. I think boomers are like even edging on barely being super nostalgic for radio. Because if you look, the other films that were big were like Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump is actually about years after Radio Days.
That makes
Pulp
sense
Fiction
to
is about the 70s. Like, it's increasingly the 70s with, like, Brady Bunch, Pulp Fiction. But, like, Ed Wood is also way after the radio, you know? It's kind of, like, interesting that that is... And there's stuff even referencing, like, the broadcast takes place in 1939, which is significant because 1939 is when the World's Fair that introduced TV came. So there's all these jokes about, like, radio will never die, but it's, like, ironically in the year where, like, radio was really about to die.
And the whole, we're not going to spoil the plot because it is kind of an interesting whodunit. I will say, very surprisingly, I felt the third act was the strongest in the film. And I think it's because they pull back a little tiny bit from the slapstick. And the whodunit plot is actually really effective. And it does involve, I think very cleverly, the invention of television. Yeah. Like, I really think that this is the ultimate, like, radio killed the video.
Killed the radio star.
Yeah.
Which is also related to The Shadow. It all comes back. It all comes back.
And yeah, I would actually, what I found so interesting is, you know, I made my partner Brendan watch this, and at about, you know, maybe like the 40-minute mark, I was like, look, I'm giving you an out. If you want to turn this off, I will wake up at 7 in the morning and finish this because I have to for this podcast. But, like, I don't want to subject you to this. He wanted to stick it through because he said he's been just watching way too many good movies lately, and it's good to remind yourself.
What else is out there?
The Diaspora film. But I'm glad he was glad we stuck with it because, like, there's something there to recommend in that third act.
For me, it's the, you know, talking about all the gags, like the constant gags. For me, it's, I think I mentioned it earlier, the character actors, when they hit the jokes, boy, do they hit the jokes. Bobcat Goldthwait has a joke in there where it's like,
the actors are improvising.
Throw your curve.
Ah! Ah!
And then he starts screaming in a way Bobcat Goldthwait only can. And I laughed really hard.
Which I think he was not allowed to up until that point, because his introduction on screen, I'm like, oh my God, is that Bobcat? And then he's not Bobcat for like an hour. And then he's
full Bobcat.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I mean, so what we should go into is that this was, you know, this was a script from the 70s that was meant to kind of happen a few times and didn't happen.
It was an idea that he wrote while filming American Graffiti. So we're looking at 73 is when it comes out, American Graffiti. He's probably writing this in 72. And so that means it's in development hell for over 20 years.
And so it starts with Hayek and Katz, his go-to writers that you probably know from
Howard the Duck,
who I always point people to their great film Messiah of Evil, which is like proves that they are not hacks. And George Lucas, much like Coppola thought that Lucas was the great thing, Lucas thought that Hayek and Katz were the most talented writers in his graduating class.
I do think they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I love
and
them.
I wonder if a lot of what we talk about, the great structure, the great mystery, is them, to be honest.
I think
so. Because it went through a million revisions, and it sounds like a lot of the revisions were trying to update and change the radio stuff, like the radio spoofs.
Like getting rid of like what essentially Lucas wants.
Yeah, getting rid of, and it also sounds interesting where it's hard to tell because it sounds like he threw out a lot of the revisions, so it's hard to know what comes and doesn't come. But the interesting thing is this was set up in 1978 for Steve Martin, Cindy Williams from Happy Days, as they would be the leads, and you're kind of like, okay, I could kind of see that, but the thing is, Star Wars was just so huge that Star Wars ate and took over everything. I wonder again if it's Batman too, you know, where Batman, part of the thing is Batman brought in this old IP again, and then part of the thing is that Lucas realized by utilizing computer generated imagery to create a lot of the sets, which would be very costly, he could get this down to about $10 million. And the other deal made is that almost all of the cast is from television. Mary Stuart Masterson is about the only actor, because even somebody like Jeffrey Tambor at the time was mostly from Larry Sanders.
And Corbin Benson's Burnson, on this from LA Law, which from LA Law, which would have been a huge show in 93, 94. It's interesting. It is budgeted at $10 million because of what ILM can do. And then somehow it skyrockets to $15 million, which doesn't sound like that much, but that is a huge increase.
And especially
in budget. And then
with how they like scuttled its release immediately. That $5 million would have made a huge difference, probably.
It only made $1.37 million. At the box office, opening in almost 1,000 theaters, which at first I thought, oh, it must be a limited opening situation. This was in every multiplex in North America and made one $0.37 million and then dropped 78% in its second.
That's painful. And this is also the era where, of course, if it starts dropping, a theater just cuts it out, right? Like, after a week, it's gone. So this is where...
Flintstones is back in theaters. Exactly.
This is where I think they made the fatal mistake, where kind of all these fatal mistakes pile up. Mel Smith, a very interesting director. Like I say, tall man... Great. He is a British comedian. He's from Not the 9 o'clock News. He's a sketch guy. He really gets it. So that's partially why you're kind of fascinated why this didn't work. And you're like, how much was Lucas? He hates Lucas. You can tell he maybe made up a weird story about Lucas trying to make a film of all CGI actors.
Yeah, so he claimed that he was buying up all of these rights to dead people's likenesses, visages, and then he said that they would be putting together a movie where, like, Orson Welles would be hanging out with, like, Gina Davis and Madonna. Like, it's just
Which
wild.
Which fascinates me, because...
There is a duck that's shot in this film. It's a fake duck. It is essentially Howard.
Okay, well...
if you zoom in on that shot, it's a very small joke, and there's too many jokes in this to even, like, notice it. But as someone who was very cognizant of Howard the Duck, I was like, they just shot Howard the Duck.
I mean, that's probably just something from the radio I don't know or remember.
No, but I think it's a smear campaign on Howard the Duck.
The shooting, that whole element with the check jacket that Michael McKean is wearing and doing, like, all this stuff, that's a Spike Jones routine. Yeah.
But anyway, the Mel Smith is kind of interesting, but he worked on Dream On, which is the show that made Brian Benben famous. Dream On... Interestingly, I wonder if it's also a meta casting commentary, because Dream On is all about a guy who is so obsessed with television and movies that it infects his life. That show, you and I probably don't know, or we were too young for it. Also, if you lived in Canada, it's an HBO show that we did not get. But it's a show that just it doesn't exist anymore, partially because it was full of these licensed clips of movies and television.
It's absolutely
the Muppet Babies. It's 100% Muppet Babies starring Brian Benben. Also, it had boobs in it, so people loved a sitcom with boobs. But it was on for years, and Brian Benben was kind of a deal. Like, there's a Brian Benben sitcom that he had. But I think he's just a very TV guy. I don't think he's doing a bad job, but I think if it was Michael J. Fox or Michael Keaton, you would get more than $1.3 million at the box office.
God, Michael Keaton would have been so good.
Yeah, and I don't even think Brian Benben is bad. He just doesn't have a draw.
No.
He just doesn't have the... And, like, if you compare... Like, Mary Stuart Masterson was pretty big at the time, and she does a good...
And she's
good.
Yeah,
I think both of them are equally good, but it's just, like, Brian Benben is not a celebrity who has a draw. And so I think that Mel Smith brought him... The interesting thing that, like, with the slapstick not working and the jokes all the time not working, one of his movies that's kind of buried that people also really love is this movie called Brain Donors, which is essentially a Marx Brothers script starring John Turturro. A certain comedy fan loves it because it's like a Marx Brothers movie that never got made. And it's essentially people just doing Marx Brothers shtick. So the weird thing is he kind of has in his belt. And I mean, tall guy features Rowan Atkinson doing a lot of kind of classic vaudeville style humor. So you know that he can kind of do it. So there's something falling apart between the script and the actor and Lucas. And you think with his bristling against Lucas... it's weird. He ended up directing the Mr. Bean movie, which some people have a great fondness
for. I was like, in my head, something just popped in where this man goes on to make my favorite film from childhood, Bean.
Well, he was really big in Rowan Atkinson's career.
I mean, that makes sense. I loved Bean. And I think Sandra Oh had her first Hollywood role in
perhaps.
Bean.
Perhaps. Is it before or after Arliss? That's always the other question.
It's before, I think. Yeah.
Well, I want to take us back to the CGI, because until it was, like, actually freeze-framed in certain elements, I couldn't tell it was CGI. But it is...
Agreed.
Really gorgeous. Like, it's really
very
impressive.
Effective.
And Lucas himself went on the promotional trail talking about the CGI, because that was what I think, if anything, this is not a failure in that he got it out there that you could start using CGI in this way incredibly inexpensively. And that was kind of the point. And my favorite is there's a Bobby Wygant interview with him where she is just so obsessed with the idea that now they can make lava look real. And he's like, actually, I'm thinking about using it for, like, characters, and we'll be able to have these incredible interactive characters. And she's like, but lava will look real, right?
Listen, and I think as much as like, we love Bobby Wygant partially because her entire archives are online.
Yes.
That's the real reason she's the fourth anchor of the show.
Yeah.
But she's not. I wonder if she knew about the upcoming competing Volcano movies, because those are coming up. Bobby probably had a tip. She probably literally talked to somebody who talked about lava in Volcano and Dante's Peak, and
which is going to be on this podcast for sure for season coming up. 1997.
She got shook by Lucas, but yeah, the interesting thing I think to point out, and a special reason to watch this if you're a fan of Lucas, is this is really the prototype for the Star Wars prequels, which famously were one of the first big movies with all computer generated sets. So
I see so much of the DNA of Jar Jar Binks in Radioland Murders in terms of just the jokes that don't work and the completely being out of touch with what the current generation finds funny. Not that I think Jar Jar Binks would have been laughed at in 1939, but there is a bit of Jar Jar in Radioland Murders for sure.
I can see that.
Cam doesn't really.
No, I get it. I also think that weirdly, I think Jar Jar might have been laughed at in 1939.
Don't count Jar Jar. Maybe that's where he belongs.
He wrote The Phantom Menace for his kids, though, right? Like he wrote it with them in mind.
He definitely thought kids would love Jar Jar. Is what you know for sure.
He
thought Jar Jar would be the number one kid thing. Yeah, I don't know. Another thing I just wanted to point out, kind of among all these interesting actors and interesting cameos, is this is the last role of a very interesting actress, Anita Morris, who was a big Broadway star, who did a lot of stuff with, like, Jesus Christ Superstar. She originated a role in Nine. She was kind of a huge star. She plays the sultry lady who's the sexy voice who's sleeping with everybody.
The va-va-va-voom girl with the va-va-va-voom voice.
Yes.
Yeah, she passed away from ovarian cancer just a few weeks after filming. She was someone that had been diagnosed 14 years earlier and told that she wouldn't survive a year. And she actually started her career in film upon that diagnosis. And I think if you would recognize her from another film, it's a really excellent film on Disney Plus right now called, I say Disney Plus because if it's Disney, we ain't getting it on Hollywood Suite, called Ruthless People. She's like Danny DeVito's mistress in that. Just like this burlesque, classic burlesque body, really, really good actress. I really liked her.
Yeah, she's super cool and wasn't in a ton of films, so she's kind of one of those Broadway people. And fascinatingly, she is the mother of actor James Badge Dale, which I think a lot of people may not know because he was, you know, she died quite young. Her and Grover Dale, who's a pretty famous choreographer. You may know him as a former lover of Anthony Perkins. They had James Badge Dale together. So it's like kind of a fascinating person to see in this role, and I think she has a lot of fun with it, and it's great that she had this kind of final role.
Perfectly
too.
Cast.
Yeah, if we're doing this too, I want to point people towards Stephen Tobolowsky, who is one of my personal favorite, and not just one of my personal favorite, I'm sure like many people's favorite character actors. He's someone who has 277 IMDb.
He's kind of the MVP in this.
So good. He grounds it so well,
so
and
funny.
He's the only one who is deadpanning his lines. He's the only one who's not yelling or screaming. He's just like, slid in jokes.
He
looks
like a 1939 actor.
Yeah,
he's amazing.
Totally. I mean, and I'm fascinated. Let me say that one thing I was shocked by, I literally wrote myself a note being like, look up Tobolowsky talking about this movie, because he loves talking about movies. He loves weaving an anecdote. He used to have a podcast where it was just kind of like, ask him a question. But whoever interviews Stephen Tobolowsky next, ask him about Radioland Murders, because I can find nothing of him talking about Radioland Murders. And he has a very significant role, and it's pretty early in his career, so...
Including like the climax of the film, which we don't want to spoil, like this really special effects laden, actually quite effective King Kong-esque, set piece that he's involved in. He's great. He sells it completely.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so much. I love him so much that we were originally going to name our dog Stephen Tobolowsky, the dog, not the noted character actor.
Oh my God.
I like Ginger Ruffers. Yeah. I'm glad you went with Ginger Ruffers.
Yeah, well, we got a girl dog. That's it. We've been calling her the Duchess lately because, there's some attitude going on there. All right. I think that sort of regality is going to take us into our next film. So when we come back, we're going to go into a movie that I absolutely love and I'm going to make a case for. It's The Shadow. And that's coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Before Batman, before V for Vendetta, heck, even before Darkwing Duck, who knew what evil lurked in the hearts of men? The Shadow. Although, like the Flintstones, The Shadow had been bouncing around Hollywood since the early 80s, the 90s became the time for trying to revitalize the classic 30s and 40s comic book and radio drama characters. From The Phantom to The Rocketeer, movie after movie did their best to hit the Batman franchise jackpot. They all failed. But for the life of me, I cannot figure out why the Alec Baldwin starring visual extravaganza that is The Shadow didn't take off, at least in some capacity. I mean, this is the closest we are ever going to get to see Alec Baldwin play Batman. Now, I have to admit, I am a little biased. I love classic radio dramas. I love The Shadow and Margot Lane as characters. And I am going to do my best not to make this. Here is why 1994's The Shadow requires a full and complete reevaluation as an awesome blockbuster movie, a lecture.
Which was a B cut that got cut out of the show where you for right. like 7 minutes without any cut.
That's what I was going to say.
Just on camera was so fast talking The Shadow. And we wanted to keep it. Yet it didn't make it because no one else would agree with you. And, here we are in the podcast.
And I feel like after, and you put this in for the podcast for me just so I could have this. Okay. But I feel like at the end of my rant that I did, which I'm very proud of, you, Alicia, were like, huh, maybe I need to go rewatch it. Now, have I swung you around at all to this is not a complete disaster?
No. Well, no, there's things I really appreciate about this, but I do remember you being so persuasive because I did watch it for the show that we filmed and was going to talk about it, but was having a hard time sort of how to characterize it without saying like, man, is this bad. But you persuaded me. And then so I was like, put in the podcast and was really excited to come back to this. And I'm still excited to talk about it. I think it's a fascinating film to talk about. But in terms of, is this a masterpiece? Which I don't think is what you're saying. And let's keep in mind for listeners, I think every listener can relate. Like there's films we grew up with that we are so fond of. And sure, in our adulthood, they don't live up. But it's different for an adult coming to it fresh. We don't see it through the eyes of that, you know, nostalgia and childhood. So you and I are a little bit of opposing sides. And I think Cam is the middle ground.
I'll accept.
And I mean, on later understanding, I now know why this did not at least garner a bigger box office. And it didn't fail. Like, it actually did okay. It made its money back and more. It just didn't get us. It wasn't like get a sequel good. Yeah.
To give an example for like how this was, you know, the reason why it might be called a failure is they really thought this was going to be the birth of a franchise where you'd have multiple films like the Batman Burton franchise. And they even made and completed an SNES, game and pulled it because it wasn't worth marketing.
That's like, the signal for me is there is all this merch that they just got rid of.
There was a clothing line for children, men and women were coming out with that
and
they just let it
like
go.
Which, you know, we were talking a lot about Batman, but I think probably we need to also bring in 1990s Dick Tracy, which maybe is even more similar in some ways, where Dick Tracy made money. I mean, it's hard to revisit Dick Tracy because that should be such a better film, and there's some incredible performances. But in terms of the merchandising, I mean, like, I remember having my brother having Dick Tracy sheets, and even though it didn't get highly reviewed, it did well at the box office, and I think there was a Dick Tracy phone maybe my friend had in her basement.
You could talk. Yeah, Dick
so
Tracy,
that's where The Shadow was going.
The vertical integration of Dick Tracy, I think, did well enough that part of me assumes the reason there wasn't a sequel was probably just Beatty fighting, you know? Because they probably would have been interested in something.
Probably.
But, you know, and that's a film that's helmed by Warren Beatty, like top, you know, Hollywood legend, really amazing director of Heaven Can Wait, which we talked about on the podcast. The Shadow's different, you know, but I can see where their eyes were on Dick Tracy and a bit of Batman, and maybe that's the wrong approach to take, I would argue.
Hell yeah. Well, we'll get into all this. And let's just say that the reason why, and very cut and dry, the reason why this did not make the multitudes of millions that it should have was it was released opposite The Lion King. And it just, you know, decimated it for obvious reasons. Because if you're taking your young person to something, you're going to take them to, The Lion King. And this is just like a little too adult, but still a little too young. Like it sits in like a weird demographic. But before we go anywhere else, Alicia, give us a little bit of a plot summary on this one.
So I mean, The Shadow, you know, for those of you not familiar with it, it's not actually a comic book adaptation in the way that Dick Tracy's more newspaper, or in the way that Batman is. It really originates the source material in 1930 on the radio, which is why we're talking about it in this episode dedicated to radio adaptations. So it's the creation of Walter B. Gibson, and it appears in a radio show called The Detective Story Hour in 1930. This character is like a side character called The Shadow, and he can kind of through mind control make the appearance of objects as well as himself appear different for people, if that makes sense.
Cloud
so he
men's
can kind
minds.
Of cloud people's minds. So that means, this is important to the film, that when Alec Baldwin, who is Lamont Cranston, so Lamont Cranston's kind of the Bruce Wayne character in this film, where Batman is the Shadow. Lamont Cranston is Alec Baldwin and looks like Alec Baldwin. When he's the Shadow, he's in prosthetics and looks like an entirely different person.
I was gonna say, I think he looks like an entirely different Baldwin. He looks like one of his brothers.
Yeah, so basically they put Billy Baldwin prosthetics on Alec Baldwin. This like rounder nose and this slantier kind of forehead.
But I like that they bothered to do that, because they could have just wrapped him in a big scarf and a big hat, right?
But, and let's put a pin in that, and maybe that can be our redemptive. Sure. But so this character appears on the radio, and then it doesn't appear on radio again in a dedicated way until like the late 30s, like 1937. It's actually, The Shadow becomes one of the top selling serialized pulp magazine stories, and later its own novels throughout the 1930s. So like Radioland Murders, which takes place in 1939, this is very much a 30s and early 40s narrative. Incredibly popular. You know, this is really what a lot of people have said. Bob Kane was inspired for Batman. He was inspired by The Shadow. And there's a lot of commonality here. And I would argue, when watching the production design of this film, there's a lot of Gotham City a la Burton, 89 and 92.
Oh, yes. Real Burton.
Which I think
real
is very
Burton
actually effective.
From the
it's effective.
Yeah. Alicia, I feel like one of the things you would appreciate most about this is that, like, the design of it is gorgeous. Like, the city looks amazing. Oh.
Stunning. Yep. And I hate that I watched this in, you know, like not like on my computer, essentially. I know, broken record. I would, if this someone played this theatrically in a proper, you know, digital version, or God forbid, a 35mm print, I'd be there in a heartbeat just for the gorgeous set pieces. This is a film that opens in Tibet. So it's very, very Batman Begins. I got to say, Christopher Nolan, looking at this and looking at the Frank Miller, you know, Batman Begins graphic novels, there's a lot here with the Ra's al Ghul character. In this case, it's played by John Lone, who is an actor I want to talk a bit about, because I'm endlessly fascinated by John Lone, and he is somewhat of a missing person right now. But he is the embodiment of Genghis Khan, who also has these skills, the same as the Shadow. The Shadow is someone who was a World War I soldier who was traumatized by the war and then decides to become a drug
Evil.
Kingpin warlord.
Which I do kind of like that the white dude is the one coming in and fucking it up for all the Asian people.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
thank
you.
A metaphor
there.
Yeah,
the captain. It's opium and heroin. And they keep that in the movie, which I really like.
And then this master who can, you know, kind of master this mind control, takes him in, teaches him, you know, kind of the crime fighter ways and all of the things. And he then goes back to New York and, you know, becomes a crime fighter a la Batman. Meanwhile, John Lone, who's playing Genghis Khan,
he's the only living descendant of Genghis Khan, which with modern DNA we know is not a thing.
Ridiculous. Yeah. 8% of the planet is related to Genghis Khan.
I can't remember the documentary, but there's a great documentary about the descendants of Genghis Khan, and there's a French village, which looks like a fairly normal French village, but they all have, if you don't know, famously the descendants of Genghis Khan many of them have this birthmark on their tailbone, and almost everyone in this French village has it. And the French village has an old French tradition, quote unquote, of when a body is buried, only two people who they don't know who they are secretly bury it somewhere, and that's actually a Mongol tradition, so you wouldn't rob the bodies.
That's wild. I mean, that's a whole podcast.
Yeah,
episode
exactly. Somebody yeah, neither talk here about nor the there French for a year.
But wow. Anyway, this guy's the only, which is we know is an accurate descendant. And yeah, it you know, there's set pieces in the museum. We've got Tim Curry as this sort of assistant to Ian McKellen, who's in this film, who are developing, let's say, for better or worse, like a nuclear
bomb. Developing
not
MacGuffins.
That, but
yes,
yeah, a bomb, which, you know, John Lone's character is then going to use to blow up the Earth or something like that. And then you have Margot Lane, who's a rumored either cousin or sister of Lois Lane from Superman, who is the love interest here, played by Penelope Ann Miller. I know you're going to defend her to the death, but for me, she's the weakest.
I have no. I'm not defending this one to the death. That's actually, I think, the biggest problem with this film.
Costume's beautiful.
And,
yeah,
she is an incredibly gorgeous clothes rack, and that's the problem. Yeah. She does get one of the best lines, or get to be part of one of the best jokes in the whole thing, which is.
Oh God, I dreamed.
So did I. What did you dream?
I was lying naked on the beach in the South Seas, and the tide was coming up. The sun was beating down. My skin was hot and cool at the same time. What was yours?
I dreamed I tore all the skin off my face and was somebody else underneath.
You have problems.
I'm aware of that.
Which you see, I have to say, you see that dream. Yeah. So you see, I think this is one of the most effective scenes, is Alec Baldwin in his disguise. Well, no, he's Alec Baldwin as Lamont Cranston, and he starts ripping off the Lamont Cranston skin to reveal the scary shadow and then turn into the John Lone character.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, I mean,
I was all for it.
I think what, so we'll go into it probably a bit more, but the David Koepp script, which is, he's kind of the guy who broke this, what he chooses to do and what makes, to me, as like a superhero fan, what makes this movie interesting is he chooses to make it that essentially the master taught Lamont Cranston to use his evil side, which was like the weird, you know, long fingernailed heroin dealer, to essentially hone it into the shadow, to use evil to fight crime. But Lamont Cranston is constantly feeling that he has this evil inside of him that he's struggling against. And then the cool thing that they do, which John Lone is so good at selling, is Siwon Khan doesn't come to town to fight the shadow. He is impressed by the shadow and essentially says, like, you aren't the good guy, you're evil. Come with me and be evil. Like, his whole thing is essentially constantly taunting Lamont Cranston. He's like, I want the shadow. I want that guy to be on my side.
There's some queerness.
Oh, absolutely. They love to have dinner with each other. They rarely like punch each other. They love to just look and talk to each other and ask each other about their fancy suits.
The Brooks Brothers joke is also one of my favorite jokes. And it was also, the radio show was originally sponsored by Brooks Brothers. So that's like how you do the nod, but without making it too much, because it's a good joke while still a nod, right?
Lovely tie, by the way. May I ask where you acquire it?
Brooks Brothers.
Is that Midtown?
45th and Madison. You are a barbarian.
Thank you. We both are.
They work in some really great radio sponsorship stuff with, like, all the billboards that are in the city. There's one that's smoking a cigarette, which was, of course, the Camel cigarette billboards in New York all smoked. Like, actual had smoke coming out of them.
That
was another sponsor.
Such a wonderful layered joke.
Yeah.
Because they're making fun of camels by calling it a llama. But then, of course, he goes to Tibet and is taught by a monk. So I'd climb a mountain for a llama is also like a fun,
very funny
meta joke. Oh, man, I love it.
I will also say it could be a meta joke towards Howard the Duck.
Oh, my God.
Which also in 1986. Stop it.
No,
let me talk.
I don't
stop it.
Believe it.
In this, you're the one who told me this, Cam, okay. So you better believe it. In 1986, the advertising campaign for Howard the Duck in Los Angeles had Howard on billboards with a real cigar smoking. You tell me that in 1994 that's not a reference to Howard the Duck.
I think it's the last smoking billboard I heard of, to be fair.
Yeah, it was banned for obvious reasons. Fires.
Bring back smoking like, billboards is what I will say.
Well, I want to bring us back to John Lone. And honestly, this movie also has some really great AAPI representation in it. Because, yes, the bad guy is Asian. And you do have a white guy versus, you know, a bad guy Asian person. But they make sure to balance that out as you have Sab Shimono is playing a doctor. A nuclear physicist who helps them out as well. So you get different people in different roles that you wouldn't necessarily see in a movie, especially at this time. And the other thing I love about Siwon Khan is he is like super sexy and super suave and like on the same level as Lamont Cranston, matching him beat for beat for beat until the very end. And you don't get to see that in these kinds of villains, especially when it's portrayed by people of color.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a carryover of John Lone being the sexiest man alive in every film he appeared in prior to this, and the very few films he did after, because he quits acting in a big way. But you know, if I think of a film, you know, the film that's a year before this in 1983 is David Cronenberg's M. Butterfly, which stars
which
John
certainly
Lone.
Got him the role, you think, right?
I would think so, but I also wonder about
the Michael actually Cimino. Year of the Dragon probably did.
Is that the right? But
yeah,
am I?
That's 80s. So he's in it. Yeah.
I mean, I know he's in 85. It. But is it 80s?
Yeah. 85.
Okay. Yeah. Saw that in 70mm and holy moly. But yeah. So there's, you know, and he's in one of the Beverly Hills Cops. Yeah. He, Iceman was probably the film that made him a star. He's kind of forgotten today, and he shouldn't be. He gives up acting. I do think he did. I remember seeing maybe a few years ago he did do something on television. So he might be back in the. In the saddle, both the saddle, because he also lives on a horse ranch, and the you know, the metaphorical saddle.
But yeah, I want to go back a bit to the like the Asian American representation that you talk about, because it is this weird boom. We talked a bit about the kind of boom and bust of Asian representation or black representation in the early 90s, and I think Asian representation had a very similar boom and bust, and you see a lot of those great actors represented here, including a quick James Hong cameo.
Blink and you must
I mean, he gets murdered, to his credit,
but it's a great death. It's very memorable
death. And he gets a great speech, but yeah, there's this interesting thing where it gets deep into like representation politics, where like is it a representation at any cost? But I definitely sat down to this wondering, like, I remember it's like a con bad guy, and obviously it's all based on Yellow Peril stuff, so is it going to be dicey? But like you say, the fact that there's Asian American characters is like, that's what nowadays we'd be like, oh, that is a good balance. But yeah, the same coming up, of course, there was kind of the bad stuff, but at the same time that was representations, people like Short Round, people like Long Duck Dong, Data in the Goonies, those characters, it's interesting that in the late 90s there just are not Asian characters. So you start to wonder, like, were those characters better than nothing? But actually, around now is when you have a great boom of positive Asian representation, stuff like the Joy Luck Club, stuff like, you know, the Turtles go back in time to be with Asian characters. Basically, there are so many Asian actors at the time becoming famous, and it's kind of interesting that it's a fascinating like time, and it kind of goes away. And 1994 is also actually, I believe, the debut of All American Girl, the Margaret Cho sitcom, which was at the time the first ever all Asian cast sitcom ever, and then I believe it was the only one ever until Fresh Off the Boat, which also shows you that weird dip again. And I have no explanation for why that representation really went away, and I think John Lone's a perfect example of that, where it's like, here he is absolutely holding his own as the full star of a movie, and he's a guy, you know, he comes from the Peking Opera, so he probably has crazy skills that are not even on display.
Specifically the Shanghai Opera, because I got confused. I know that that's very minutiae, but he was an orphan that was adopted. His name Lone is because he was adopted as an orphan in Shanghai.
Can we make a movie about this man?
I was just going to say, can someone listening get it, like, find him, make a documentary, or write, like, can
he makes
do a profile
documentaries
and...
too. It's worth saying. He's a documentarian. Oh, he has a couple under his belt. I think he did a couple
of American
Masters episodes.
I will say, too, for 94, coming back to a year in film, like, Double Happiness, on the Canadian side, you have one of the most important depictions of Asian Canadians from an Asian Canadian director starring Sandra Oh, it launched her career, is 1984. And luckily, Sandra Oh, well, it takes a little while till she gets that Bean casting call, but like it would take her a little while too before she got the role she deserved.
And I mean, it's interesting with this era of media, you do see a lot of people trying to go back to it, and actually a lot of famous Asian actors. There's quite often films set up trying to pick apart, find a modern way to represent characters like Fu Manchu.
Yeah.
And I know, oh my God.
Dragon Ladies.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of Asian actors often have the rights to Charlie Chan and are trying to, because there were these popular Asian characters throughout the history of cinema and novels, but they were based on bad stereotypes. And
looking at the 30s specifically, if you want to look at the era where The Shadow was one of the most popular icons, you know, globally, really, someone like Anna May Wong, who was a very important actress beginning in the silent era when she was incredibly young, but then transitions very successfully in the 1930s and again into television in the 50s before her life. She died quite young, but she had her own TV show in the 50s, which everyone forgets. You know, she was the original kind of dragon lady who, one, had never set foot in China until like her 30s when she went to meet her father for the first time. Like, but all of her biography, whenever you read about Anne May Wong, she was, you know, born in Peking and like came to San Francisco as a teenager. And it was all untrue. And she is someone that I today in 2021 am seeing so many people now aware of Anna May Wong. I believe there's a biopic in the order. There's been 3 biographies written on her in the last 5 years. She's no longer this person whose name you could only say at archival film festivals to get acknowledgement. She's now like a fully fleshed out person. And I think looking back at the 30s, like that Orientalism that was so incredibly present and that eroticization very much is both Charlie Chan, but also Anna May Wong in terms of fetishizing it sexually.
Yeah, oh, sure.
Well, I mean, this is the era where a film adaptation of a very famous book, The Good Earth, you know, Anna May Wong wants the role, which is obviously of a Chinese woman, and it goes to German Louise Rainier in Yellowface, who wins an Academy Award
Jesus
for it.
Christ.
So, like,
and I mean, when you,
that's sort of the era we're talking about.
Look at Siwon Khan and all the great Asian villains, I think you can also look at, like, Sesue Hayakawa, who was a sex symbol, but could be the villain, because they would not have, you know, you couldn't really have an interracial couple, and they wouldn't really bother to have an Asian lead woman that often, so he was mostly pigeonholed as a villain.
His wife did produce films where they were able to star as a couple, like the Dragon Painter would be a good example. Thanks for bringing up Seisio Hayakawa, is a name that's come out of my mouth.
He's up there with Valentino as like the sexiest silent film
and was he ever. If anyone wants to just go on YouTube, 1915's The Cheat, directed by Cecil B. DeMille, starring Seisio Hayakawa. Complicated film for sure.
That's the thing.
My God, though.
I would say that The Shadow is complicated. As much as we can praise it, it's still a little complicated because, again, it's an Asian man menacing a white woman at certain points. It's not free of it, but it's kind of interesting when you see this and you think about, like, for instance, 10-ish years later, Marvel was absolutely, until another 10 years, afraid to touch a lot of their Asian villains. They turned the Mandarin into another racist stereotype, which was a Islamic terrorist organization in Iron Man, first the Ten Rings, and then they made it this kind of goofy caricature with Ben Kingsley. But now they're finally in Shang-Chi, they're gonna have a guy playing the character again who's gonna be Asian, but it's because they had to get an Asian director and Asian writer because they're, you know.
Or, you know, casting Tilda Swinton as an Asian
And they have now apologized for it, being like, bad idea, bad idea.
Which is Dr. Strange.
Yeah, I did see that one. So there's still, again, it's like this weird thing where you don't want representation. We're past representation by any means, you know? But what are you losing when you are so... Because it wasn't even a time where they were afraid of being canceled. It was the late 90s.
Yeah.
So it was just them being, like, too lazy to try.
Too lazy too racist. And too racist.
Yeah, true, I mean... true. Yeah, so it's like kind of a fascinating thing to watch this movie, like you say, Becky, that I think threads the needle wonderfully, because I was sitting down very worried that it was going to be a cringe thing.
It's not.
That aspect is handled so well.
Yeah. I think we are recommending this film.
Yes!
I think I want it.
I
want it to be more. So I get frustrated when I see so much potential in something and it squanders it. And I think whereas Radioland had such a strong third act, to me, this third act is pathetic.
Yes. Yeah. You don't like a giant ball bomb rolling around?
Yeah. The stuff I do want to point people towards, which I think totally redeems this, is number one, some of the action set pieces. So that giant thing in the water dome that Tim Curry sets off, that scene is amazing. Yeah. And Margot Lane gets that great little joke as he like washes out on top of her. And it's like, you called me? Like, that's really funny.
Yeah, you know what? I also think that there's missing, to me, jokes. Like lighthearted, you know, Batman has the Joker in it. But there's like a little more when the banter is lighthearted between Margot and the Shadow. I enjoy that. I get that they're going for a darker thing. And the other thing to remember is this was before superhero movies were allowed to be camp. And the kind of fascinating thing, of course, is David Koepp goes on to essentially bust open the doors of that with Sam Raimi and Spider-Man, which he also wrote.
Sam Raimi actually got the rights for this. So he was supposed to make the next one is what was going to happen. He was going to revitalize his character. Now, from what I can tell, the rights are lost right now. No one actually knows who it belongs to.
And it's not that it's public domain. It's that there is, I believe, a contentious lawsuit.
Sure.
All lawsuits are contentious, but you know what I mean? Like, they've been arguing for 20 years.
It's a snafu. 25 years. Now, there's different rights, though, for the radio versus the pulp.
Yes.
So there's...
You know, and that's the problem, because this film is part radio. Like, it's taking, you know, the tone of the radio show and even, like, some of the dialogue, but it's really the visuals of the pulp magazine. So, like, I don't know where you draw the line with this, actually.
And a lot of his powers are, like, a mishmash of just what David Koepp liked from one source or the other. But yeah, I think it's kind of fascinating, because I think you can see what, if, for instance, Sam Raimi apparently took a swing at it in the 80s too, and nobody wanted him, and then he just went on and made Darkman, which is essentially The Shadow.
There's a lot of stuff
that is essentially The Shadow that you're like,
it's
oh,
very
okay.
Good.
Yeah, so it's kind of fascinating, and I mean, it's interesting that it was also, I really want to know, it's produced by this guy, Martin Bregman, who is really Al Pacino's producer, and I was like,
I hear you say he's really Al Pacino.
I mean, he produced all the great Al Pacino movies, and that's partially why Penelope Ann Miller is here, because she was in Carlito's Way. It's pretty much a lot of the cast and crew of Carlito's Way, interestingly.
But Carlito's Way is 95, right? Or is it 93?
It's before, yeah. I believe it's right before.
Yeah, it's definitely before.
Yeah, I think it's 93.
But anyway, so it's kind of fascinating in that regard. But I'm also fascinated to know if it was The Shadow, he ever pictured Al Pacino as The Shadow. They claim that every actor they got is exactly who they wanted first shot. But, you know.
Can we just talk about, just quickly, because we got to wrap up, Tim Curry is the greatest in this and has one hell of a scene-stealing, chewing, like, he is at his screwball best, which you get to see in Clue and in Oscar, weirdly, that he's capable of. Like, the 90s seem to be, we need a scene stealer, let's call Tim Curry.
Well, see, I wanted more of him. I don't agree. I felt he was so underutilized
because he's so great, but that death scene is so good.
You know,
the death scene's good.
What I will say is I think the person who is phoning it in, Sir Ian McKellen.
The
worst.
We know
you want to watch the worst McKellen performance. It's probably
he can
the
have
Shadow.
Fun. He can do stuff. He's just not trying.
He's a zombie for most
of
it.
Really,
like, both literally.
Zombie.
Yeah, he said he was struggling with the accent. He's like, they hired me to play an American, and I don't.
He should have just been
accents.
A British guy. But yeah, it's very weird because we know, you know, he would go on to play Wizards and Magneto, and we know he can chew scenery with the best of them, and he's playing a daffy character, but having zero fun with it.
Yeah, I do want to point to, though, because I talked about wanting to talk about the screwball moment that I think in this works so well. It's John Lone and Tim Curry, which now it makes sense that he's an opera performer because he gets the timing. It's when Tim Curry is talking about,
who saw himself a king in my kingdom.
King? Did I say king? Maybe not the best choice of words.
No, it wasn't.
Because actually I was thinking prince tops. Not even necessarily a duke. Baron, your choice, of course, your choice.
the name, like, and he watches him as John Lone kind of pulls his face around, and as he says each line, the face is in a different position, but it's so beautifully choreographed. It's like, that screwball, that's the timing.
It's very, coming back to how we described, you know, certain films, it's very Tex Avery. In motion.
I have to end it there. I'm sorry. We're over time because we got excited, but you know, good movies, that's how this works. I'm just saying, go watch The Shadow. Bring it back. Give me some more Shadow. We'll make it so that Margot Lane is an actual partner, because that's what it's like in the books and the radio. And that's what you
I would
need.
Love a remake of
Oh, so good. There's I'd so much it. Potential. Oh my God. Okay, that having been said, Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks, Becky. One thing we forgot to mention about Radioland Murders is it features the actor Joey Lawrence from Blossom as Frank Sinatra.
Think about that for a second. Crooner. He had a music career as well. I remember my cousin had his album.
Not as a crooner. I remember the tape. I had it. It was not crooning 1939-esque music, but it is so miscast.
Yeah, the hair.
It
the
has to be slick. Seen
He's
to be
got
believed.
The hair. It slicks back. I will not defend him. I'm sorry. Cam Maitland, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. I don't know. There's so much to talk about with these movies. So it was
good,
but I don't know. Watch at your own peril.
Didn't even cover the
Russell
director.
Mulcahy.
Russell Mulcahy,
well,
who is directed
Watch Razorback. I will say watch Razorback. One of his greatest films.
Yeah, and
Australian exploitation filmmaker.
Or, as we mentioned, he directed the music video for a video Killed the Radio Star, which opened MTV, as well as 400 other music videos you will definitely recognize. So yeah, go. And he does a bunch of Teen Wolf now. Good for him.
Yeah, and I think he was really a journeyman. Why we didn't talk about him is he was just being a journeyman director, because that's I think part of why it doesn't pop is he there's none of his fingerprints on it particularly.
Someone is yelling at us right now about Highlander and Highlander 2, but that's fine.
Highlander 2, that's a piece of
okay, and you can join us again next week, where we're going to look at two movies that involve Universal monsters not produced by Universal. We're also going to talk about Ken Branagh's very gelatined up abs. And we're also going to be joined by Faculty of Horror podcast and executive editor of Room Morgue, Andrea Subisati, is going to be joining us. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @HollywoodSuite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Maines. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.